You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd, Cantor, Thomas, and Parrish, and Teamsters, Local 41. Since 1983, Boyd, Kemper, Thomas, and Parrish Law Firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have the experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients in both Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at bktplaw.com to contact us for a free consultation. And Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in varied industries. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. We proudly support the heroes in uniform that protect our country and the heroes of the healthcare industry that put their lives on the line every day to protect all of us. And we want to congratulate the Teamsters for winning their pensions. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we ask, what difference does a union make? Professor Mark Anner talked to union and non-union banana workers in Guatemala. We'll talk to him. Then, is it David against Goliath? That's what people are calling the effort to unionize the Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama. Workers are voting until March 29th. We'll find out what's going on. In the news, the House passes the PRO Act. Will workers finally get the right to organize again? And our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. It's about the 1984 British miners' strike. And now for the news.
Workers in the United States have the right to organize unions? Of course, you may say. The law passed in 1935 and is still on the books. Think again, because over the years, that law has been neutered by amendments, court decisions, rampant employer violations, such that workers take a huge risk of firing, of being fired, and often thinks it's just not worth to try to organize. Actually, since the 1970s, the AFL-CIO has been trying to get Congress to reform our labor laws. This week, it has taken a huge step toward doing that goal. On Tuesday, the House passed H.R. 842, the Protect the Right to Organize, or PRO Act. It is the most wide-ranging pro-worker rewrite of labor law since the original National Labor Relations Act of 1935, according to PAI. The vote was 225 to 206. 5 Republicans joined all but one Texas Democrat, Henry Cuellar, in voting yes. All other Republicans voted no. The PRO Act will level the playing field for workers to organize into unions. It will also undo the Supreme Court's Janus decision that made every state and local government worker in the United States a potential free rider, enjoying the benefits of a union contract but not paying dues. In fact, the PRO Act will outlaw the so-called right-to-work laws in over half of our states. Passage in the Senate looks dubious because it appears that Republicans are block voting against anything President Biden wants. Probably the only way it could pass would be if the Senate gets rid of the filibuster. It requires 60 votes to end a filibuster. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka vowed in a video press conference, "We're not going to let a minority in the Senate stop the PRO Act," but he didn't say how workers and their allies would accomplish that goal, other than to implying that the anti-PRO Act senators would pay for their vote in their next election. Trumka continued, "And in an era of extreme polarization, nearly two-thirds of Americans, 65%, approve of labor unions. So it's not surprising workers would form unions if they were given the chance. That 60 million people knocking on our doors, the PRO Act would let them in."
Not surprisingly, Republicans' hair is on fire as they claim to be workers' true defenders. Of course, they fought to a man against the just-passed stimulus that is aimed at working-class Americans who make less than $75,000 a year. Education and Labor Committee Republican leader Virginia Fox, a North Carolina Republican, joined radio stations in right-to-work states, drawing attention to the disastrous PRO Act, which she pegged as radical legislation that is a political gift to union bosses, undermines workers' rights, destroys jobs, and will cost employers billions in new annual costs. One example from First News on 570 with Mark Starling out of Asheville, North Carolina, titled its coverage of the PRO Act, "On Fighting for Freedom." Starling said, "This country is about freedom and the freedom to choose whether you want to join an organization or not. But what happens is the small group of people decide they want to have a union, then they force everybody to be in the union. That'd be like forcing everybody to go to a certain church, or forcing everybody to join Rotary or Civitan or whatever. And that's not what we're about in this country." Sorry, Mark Starling. That's not what the PRO Act is about either. Just as so-called right to work is not about your right to work job. Hardly. The PRO Act forces no one to join a union, but we'll probably hear a lot of these lies as the Senate takes up the bill.
This from the Center for Migrant Rights. On Monday, Presidents Joe Biden and Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, AMLO, held their first official meeting to discuss priorities for the U.S.-Mexico cooperation, including labor migration. Prior to the meeting, AMLO said he would propose a labor migration program resembling the Bracero program, established in 1942 to address labor shortages in the United States due to World War II. In response, the center's Avi Pena published an op-ed in Reforma, a Mexican newspaper, reminding readers what a return to the Bracero model of labor migration would mean for workers. She said the Bracero program facilitated the exploitation and discrimination of Mexican workers and served as the inspiration of the fundamentally flawed work visa programs we have today. Existing temporary labor migration programs are poorly regulated, allowing governments to delegate their responsibilities and the United States employers to set up de facto labor standards. The center has an alternative, which are rights based model for labor migration, one that allows workers to have control over their labor migration process, access to justice, and a pathway to citizenship.
The news tonight was read by Chris Mann, Judy Ansel, and I'm Christine Disney. We remind our listeners that March 8th was International Women's Day, which began as a celebration of working women after the 1909 shirtwaist workers strike in New York City. In transition to our feature tonight, we remind folks that femicide, the murder of women, is rampant in many parts of the world. We shared with you the song that was sung on Women's Day last year in the Zocalo in Mexico City by Mon Laferte and El Palomar Chorus. It's called Song Without Fears. Here's a translation of some of the lyrics. Let the state disguise, the streets tremble. Let the judges and judiciary shudder. They robbed us of our peace. They planted fear, but we've grown wings. Every minute of every week, they steal our friends. They kill our sisters, destroy their bodies. They are disappeared. Mr. President, don't forget their names for all their comrades marching for reform, for all the girls fighting in Sonora, for the women commanders fighting for Chiapas, for all the mothers searching in Tijuana. We sing without fear. We demand justice, screaming for every missing woman. Let it resonate loudly. We want each other alive.
El estado, los cielos, las calles, que tiemblen los jueces y los judiciales. Hoy a las mujeres nos quitan la calma, nos sembraron miedo, nos crecieron alas. A cada minuto de cada semana nos roban amigas, nos matan hermanas, destrozan sus cuerpos, los desaparecen. No olvides sus nombres, por favor, señor presidente. Por todas las compas luchando en reforma, por todas las morras peleando en Sonora, por las comandantas luchando por Chiapas, por todas las madres buscando en Tijuana.
Cantamos sin miedo, pedimos justicia, gritamos por cada desaparecida.
Que resuene fuerte,
nos queremos vivas,
que caiga con fuerza
el feminicida.
Yo todo lo incendio, yo todo lo rompo. Si un día algún fulano te apaga los ojos, ya nada me calla, ya todo me sobra. Si tocan a una, respondemos todas. Soy Claudia, soy Esther y soy Teresa.
Good evening. I'm Christina Disney, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. This evening, we are going to be talking to Dr. Mark Ander, Professor of Labor and Employment Relations at Pennsylvania State University and Director of the Center of Workers, Global Workers' Rights, and about his recent report on what difference does a union make, banana plantations in northern and the southern part of Guatemala. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure to join you. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. Well, At first, I read your report, and I thought it really, really hit some amazing parts of what's been going on in Guatemala, but also it reaches in, it kind of connects with not just the history, but the labor in Guatemala, specifically with the banana plantations. But first, I would like to our audience, could you tell us a little bit more about yourself and what started this report on unions in Guatemala?
Great. Well, thanks again. So yes, a little bit of background on myself. I studied in Boston up in the 80s, and I soon afterwards I moved to Central America. I was about 21, and I lived for a while in Nicaragua. I lived with the family, learned Spanish, worked with the language school there, the Solidarity Project. And from there, I went to El Salvador, where I became very interested in worker rights. I worked with labor unions. I was working with Salvadoran unions, but while I was there, I realized those unions were supported by Norwegian unionists. And those Norwegians eventually hired me to be their regional project coordinator. And through that work, I started going to Guatemala, and that was in the early 90s. And I would go pretty frequently. I've probably made at least 35 trips to Guatemala over the years. And I would go out to the banana plantations. So many years later, I left eventually to Central America, got my PhD at Cornell, I came to Penn State. And I was invited by the Solidarity Center. The Solidarity Center sort of does the international project work of the AFL-CIO. And they asked me if I could do this report on workers in global supply chains, and specifically banana workers in Guatemala. And I jumped at the opportunity. It's such a fascinating country. It has such a rich experience. And it was the last trip I made before COVID. I haven't traveled since then. I was there about a year ago this day. I was there late February, early March last year. So that's the background of the report.
Now, unions are nothing new in Guatemala or in Central America. However, up until now, what are some of the greatest struggles that unions have faced in Guatemala?
No, you're absolutely right. That's an important observation you're making, Christina. The unions, you know, they go back over 100 years in Guatemala, port workers and so on, going way back. And they've been such an important part of the history of Guatemala, fighting for things. Unions and workers normally fight for better wages, better treatment at work, but also fighting for democratization, fighting for respect for basic human dignity and freedoms. And in the process, they've been brutally repressed. So if you ask me, what's one of the greatest struggles? It's the struggle basically for their own survival and their physical well-being. When we often look at worker rights violations around the world, workers being killed for exercising their fundamental right to organize, we often first think of Colombia, and that's proper. Colombia, the more unionists are killed in Colombia, sometimes more in a year than the rest of the world combined. But Guatemala is a smaller country. So sometimes when we look at the per capita killings, there are actually more killings per capita in Guatemala than anywhere else in the world. It's one of the more dangerous places in the world to be a unionist. And that has been one of their greatest struggles.
However, people keep on unionizing because people keep on standing up and fighting back for their rights. This is, even though people are time and time again, as you said in your report, there has been a struggle. There's times of great unionization, but then there's great repression against organizers and unionists. And today we still see people fighting for their rights within unions. So can you tell us what difference does a union make? And after reading your report, I know it's more than just the pay.
Absolutely. No, very, really good point. You know, you've obviously been doing a lot of work on this, and I know you know the region well. I've been doing this for a while, and when I started to see the results, I was even shocked just how dramatic the difference is. But, you know, let's start with the pay. Unionized workers are getting more than double than non-unionized workers, the banana workers. The next that struck out to me was hours of work. I mean, we're talking about 14 hours of work more per week for the non-union workers relative to the unionized workers. I mean, this is really dramatic. They're doing, in many cases, 12-hour shifts 6 days a week. I mean, they really have almost, and then Sundays are just set aside to do the most basic things, house cleaning, laundry, all the things you need to do. And it's the back to work again, 12-hour shifts. It's really, really just unthinkable just how harshly they're treated at work, those long hours, and how little they're paid when they're not unionized. And the dramatic difference, again, that the unions make decent hours of work and, for Guatemalan standards, acceptable levels of pay. But this report goes even further. I started looking at verbal abuse, and this has been a topic that's interested me for a very long time. And I found that for workers who are not unionized, it is 81% more likely that they will be yelled at work. And we're talking yelled at in very, very vulgar terms. Now, you can have recordings of some of that. The workers out in the fields, you know, they get yelled at by the radio because the manager, and they would actually record it with their phones and stuff. So I've listened to the recordings. It's very vulgar. It's very brutal. No worker anywhere in the world should be subjected to that. But then the report goes even further, right? Separating out female workers. I asked about our team in these for this part of the research. It was all I trained women unionists and workers to do the survey work. They interviewed these women in secure locations. Female workers who are non-union are five times more likely to face sexual harassment on the job. In fact, when we started doing some of these interviews, the team that was working on this with me were saying that some of the workers said the sexual harassment started with the job interview. You know, what the person doing the interview was expecting if that woman wanted to get the job. So it's just absolutely dramatic, the differences. In contrast, the unionized places, and there's one very, very strong historic union. It goes back to 1947. It's called Sitrabi. They have a very strong collective bargaining agreement. I have it right next to me here on the bookshelf. Very strong clauses about what women are able to do in the case of sexual harassment. The women are very, very proud of what they negotiated in their collective bargaining agreement. And they said there's several important cases where managers were fired. They went through the grievance process and so on, and there were consequences for bad action. So these are, you know, some of the really dramatic difference. Now, I should say, too, to contextualize this, you have in Guatemala, sometimes they say the northern coast, it's also the Atlantic coast. That's, you know, the historic region where the unions are stronger. That's where Del Monte has these directly owned plantations. The growth is going into the southern, also known as the Pacific Coast region. And that's becoming the majority of where the bananas are being produced. So we're seeing a process. You know, Guatemala is now the largest exporter of bananas to the United States, more than any of the other, Costa Rica, all the other big producers. Guatemala is huge for the U.S. market. And more of those bananas are coming from these plantations. This is not a small isolated group. This is now the majority. Those conditions I described, that level of sexual harassment or verbal abuse, is taking place on the majority of plantations now. They're really trying to avoid the unionized part of the country and going to this non-union southern region.
So I want to talk about, with this report that you have put out, what are your recommendations or what are your next steps? So what next? You have this report out. What should be done with this report, or what are your recommendations?
Right. Great questions. Well, you know, these are pretty profound problems. The level of abuse is really pretty extreme. And I always think it's very serious problems. Like there's a lot of powerful forces and a lot of powerful interests that reinforce this system. So let me just break it down the way I see it. I mean, first, where does the abuse start? It's at the workplace. So what's going on with those owners? What's going on with those supervisors? Who's, you know, overseeing them? I mean, so we have to start with respecting worker rights at the workplace. Supervisors that are involved in that level of abuse need to be removed. It's just unacceptable to be treating workers in this way. And there's also, of course, obviously very systematic anti-union repression. I actually mapped out in the report, I put a map of Guatemala showing where the killings are taking place. And you see a lot of killings in this region. And I did that deliberately. Sometimes we get a number. So many 100 unionists were killed. With the research assistant, we went media report by media report and found the spot that they were killed and mapped it out and showed how that was close to these regions. So that this is criminal. Anyone involved in that kind of violent repression of worker rights has to face the full extent of the law. So moving then from the employers, we have the Guatemalan government. I mean, the Guatemalan government, you go back, and I know, Christina, you know the history that, well, you know, you had this Guatemalan Spring, 1944, 1954, is one of the most progressive governments in Latin America. It had one of the most progressive labor laws. And with United Fruit, which later was broken up, became Del Monte and Chiquita, and the U.S. government working together, they overthrew that government, overturned throughout that labor law, and began a brutal repression of the unionist. And the government has never, ever come close to that progressive pro-worker government that Guatemala had in the middle of the last century. So the problems at the government level are really significant, and they're constantly called out internationally in the International Labor Organization and elsewhere. failure to properly fund the Ministry of Labor, too few inspectors, inspectors that aren't properly trained, inspectors that don't have the power or are unwilling to actually impose fines if they do find anything. So all those things at the government level need to be rectified. The better labor laws, proper funding of the inspectorate, significant fines. The ILO has this term, fines that are sufficiently dissuasive. I mean, the fines have to be so significant that you never think of doing this kind of violation again. So that's the second tier, the government. Then we move up from there. We get to the multinational fresh fruit companies. And here for Guatemala, we're mainly talking about Del Monte, Chiquita, and Dole. And there, again, in some cases, and I need to emphasize this, Del Monte, for example, is the one that signs and bargains those collective bargaining agreements with the union Citrabe in the northern region. That's excellent. That's fantastic. They should be recognized for doing that and for supporting and engaging in that bargaining process. However, at the same time, they're outsourcing from the southern coast where there's union avoidance at this very extreme level. So the fresh fruit multinationals have an obligation to ensure throughout their supply chain that worker rights are respected at every step in the process. And there's a lot more they need to do. The majority of fruit is not from these directly owned unionized plantations. The majority of fresh fruit now is coming from the non-union south, and that has to be addressed. But now going above the fresh fruit companies, we get to the mega supermarkets. So here we're talking about Walmart. And while I was there, for example, Walmart was telling the fresh fruit companies they wanted to push down the price of a box of bananas by $1 a box. These are the big boxes we see in the supermarket. We're talking about going from $6.25 a box, the purchase price, down to $5.25 a box. So Walmart squeezes the fresh fruit companies. The fresh fruit companies turn around and squeeze the local management and the factory owners and the plant, the processing plants. They turn around and squeeze the workers just by one executive at Walmart saying, let's do it for a dollar less per box. And all this stuff goes down the supply chain and we get these brutal. And then someone decides the conditions are intolerable and tries to organize. And that someone ends up, you know, on the side of the road on a early weekend morning, and no one knows who killed them. So this is these decisions have consequences. So those mega fruit companies, you know, we're seeing a shift in power, not entirely from the fresh fruit companies. It's more the mega supermarkets that are starting to get the upper hand in this supply chain. And then just to end, you know, it goes up to everything from the financial sector to the governments that created these trade regimes that really encourage the sort of race to the bottom and so on, that needs to be addressed. And the last piece I'll say too, then this is in my report, the certification programs. You know, all this fruit is coming into the U.S. market and the European market with all these labels on it, and some of them have little rainforest and little frogs and all sorts of stuff. And we're supposed to think as consumers that this was ethically made, that some certifiers, these professional certifiers, go in and check out these plantations, whether they're unionized or not, but they are insured. This used to be just environment, but they put all of them put on their websites. They're now doing social compliance, which is worker rights. Well, I'll tell you what, they are failing tremendously in the task. What I could find in a very short period of time, those professional inspectors, certifiers should have picked up long ago and should have addressed it. And one of the things we learned through doing this research is management tells the workers what to say before the certifiers, the programs arrive. Go ahead,
Demi. And that's what I read part of your report of. Even it happened in a smaller portion on unionized banana plantations, but on a much larger scale on non-unionized banana plantations in Guatemala. Now we're getting to the last couple, about last 30 seconds of our show, but yes. Could you tell us where our listeners can go to learn more of what you're doing or to find more on the topic that they just listened about?
Great, sure. So Google Center for Global Workers' Rights, Penn State, you'll find this report and others. You can Google what difference does a union make, the report there. You can get to that report. There's other great organizations doing work. One in Europe is called Banana Link. So Google Banana Link for this. In the U.S., International Labor Rights Forum does work on this. The International Union of Food Workers also does a lot of great work in this area.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you for all the good work you do. I enjoyed listening to your program earlier. So thank you.
Thank you. And for our listeners, that was Dr. Mark Annard talking about what a difference a union makes in banana plantations in Guatemala. I'm Christine Disming, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum.
I'm Mary Grilt. Sometimes the characters I play on Shots in the Night are feisty.
I told you, eat your head cheese or there'll be no fried Mars bars and haggis for dessert.
Some are ornery.
Where's your fat wife with Coca-Cola? She hitchhiked to the bottling plant fort.
Some are helpful. Oh, honey, you got to keep off them drugs till after your shift. Join me and my fellow actors for an hour of Shots in the Night at 7 p.m.
on the second Thursday of each month.
Hello, I'm Governor Laura Kelly. Are you ready to cumbia together again? So are we. The COVID-19 vaccines are here. They're safe, free, and for everyone. But the COVID-19 vaccine distribution phases will still take months for all of us to get vaccinated. In the meantime, we must keep wearing masks, washing hands, and keeping distance from each other. We know this isn't easy, but let's make this sacrifice for some more months so we can safely dance together.
You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains, we gon' walk it out and move mountains. And I'll rise like the day. I'll rise unafraid. I'll rise up, and I do it 1,000 times again. And I'll rise up, I like the waves. I'll rise up, in spite of the ache. I'll rise up, and I do it 1,000. Silence is a quiet, and it feels like it's getting hard to breathe. And I know you feel like dying, but I promise we'll take the world to its feet. Move mountains, bring it to its feet.
Welcome to the second half of the Heartland Labor Forum. The song you've just heard or listened to is Rise Up by Andra Day. She wrote the song as a prayer for herself during a difficult time, but the rousing song resonated widely with activist communities after its 2015 release. The Black Lives Matter movement in particular adopted this. Tonight, our topic is the organizing drive by Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama. We're going to see the organizing drive through the activities of a community support team by the name of Bamazon Community Organizing Team, or BCOT. Our guests tonight are members of the BCOT team, Eric Hall and Haley Zarsnick. And we have a special guest, a union organizer, Mike Foster. Welcome, Haley, Eric, and Mike.
Hey, welcome. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming. So what is the Bamazon organizing team?
So our team came together a little over a month ago to try and see what we could do as community organizations to support the union drive. And we have created a couple of different forums where we can bring people together and, you know, trying to prioritize asks from the union. We have done done a couple of different things, from organizing canvassing, trying to organize getting messages of support from the community, and trying to make support in the community more visible. So that's a lot of the goals of our canvassing. And we think that last part's really important, because talking to people in the communities where workers live, we've been able to get signs up of support in people's yards. We've heard and collected people's stories about why they're pro-union, and we've just been able to make a lot of good happen. So it's been a great experience to be part of BCOP.
So what organizations are part of the BAMAZON organizing team? What groups comprise this coalition?
Well, as far as the community support arm, that consists of several local grassroots organizations, to include Our Revolution Birmingham chapter, the Democratic Socialists of America Birmingham chapter, SWEET, which is an energy company, also Greater Birmingham Ministries, Black Lives Matter Birmingham chapter, and I think that's about it. It's about six organizations, but it's literally comprised of community organizers, people who live in the city limits or stay within the county limits, that really just want to see change take place. And we're really on the ground every day to create a better Alabama and make life better for our community members. And so, those are the organizations that's on the ground. And of course, we have national support. Definitely have to acknowledge our national organizations who have been very supportive in our efforts. In organizing the group, I oftentimes make sure that, you know, everyone know that it's important that local lead and national organizations provide support. And so far, you know, we have really been following the lead of RWDSU. We've been meeting with the organizers and the staff there daily, just to kind of see how can we support. And so that support has ranged from, of course, as Haley mentioned, we've been canvassing, we've been providing security measures, just being an extra set of eyes for the staff members who are on the grounds or at the gates, making sure that they're safe. We've been doing a lot, you know, as it relates to just providing that education component regarding why unions matter, why unions are important. We realize that a lot of younger generation really didn't understand the importance and the relevance of having unions. And so we have literally been going to barbershops, grocery stores, beauty shops, neighborhood corners, gas stations, everywhere where people frequent, and just having these important conversations of why unions matter. And we feel really comfortable. We feel good. And we're looking forward to having a union come March 30th.
So maybe Mike will weigh in on this, but why is that community support so important? Can't the unions just organize on their own?
Well, support is important in anything that you do. I mean, everybody got to have some support from somewhere. And I just think it's important, as the RWDSU, when we're organizing, that we're showing our compassion and our solidarity is not just for the company, but for the community as well. We want to spread that unity, not just through the company, but through the community. So the community, and on the other hand, is showing their solidarity by standing with brothers and sisters and cousins and uncles that works in that facility, knowing that they need the support. I mean, that's just the love, the heart of this whole thing that we're trying to prove. And that's something that we're trying to put on blast, is support of one another to reach a goal that's going to benefit thousands of people and just allow the community to grow. Because I believe there's one thing that people don't know and don't understand, is that Bessemer is one of the poorest cities in the state of Alabama. So that's why the community support is so important right now, because this just don't affect the workers at Amazon. It affects the community.
So yes, and even through history, that shows that the areas that are heavily unionized do better. The whole community. I see what you're saying. So how is labor support for the organizing drive? Other unions, how are they helping with this?
I mean, different people are doing different things, just like he was just explaining about they canvassing and doing things of that sort. They're going out into the neighborhood supporting. And just like I appreciate everything the most about the extra eyes out there, making sure those guys and I are safe on them blocks and on those corners while we're trying to support another group of people. And, you know, other union agencies have been coming in, and just like he explained, they've been supporting and not trying to lead and let the local lead, because the local is the connection. It's the community connection. So it's important, like you said, I truly believe that statement, that everybody from the outside needs to be just the supporters to allow the people that are local to grow within the midst of the community and allow everybody to be connected in that way.
So here's a question for everybody. Why do you think Amazon workers are leading this drive at this point in history? What precipitated this organizing drive for the workers?
I guess I could go first. It doesn't. I think that the workers at Amazon came to the conclusion that if we don't stand up for ourselves and speak out, how can we receive help? I mean, how can anybody know that anything is going on wrong if don't nobody say anything? And not just allowing them to speak out, but at one point in time, they were speaking out and nobody heard them. So they reached out to us to help them elevate their voice, to allow their voice to be heard, because we as the union provides ourselves to be like a speaker for them to speak through and together, not as a third party, but as a unity. So they know it's them that's leading this. The union has not done nothing but support them, because they are the ones who's leading history right now. They are the ones that are making history. It's them that's battling this fight, and we're just the support. And that's all we are. And that's why it's important that they lead this battle, so nobody can say it's the union saying this. No, it's the people. Not the union, but the people are standing up because they said they're tired. And now it's not just the local Amazon. It's other Amazons also are saying, hey, we see what's going on in Alabama, and I think we should do the same thing because nobody's hearing us.
Yeah, can we go back just a second? I know you guys mentioned two times the need for security. What is happening? Do you feel threatened when you go out and talk to people, especially the organizers?
Me personally, not at all. We haven't had any issues to where we'll feel like that our lives are being threatened or anything of that matter. I guess it's just a sense of trying to make sure that we're marking all of our dotting the I's and crossing the T's. I guess that's the sense of it. It's just to be, you know, cautious, because we're not ignorant to the fact of the things of people have done in the past. We're definitely not ignorant to that fact, but at the same time, It has been a blessing. We have been organizing by the grace of God. He's been covering us. And I just believe he's going to continue to do that. I just appreciate the security. You always appreciate somebody that's looking out for you. But I definitely believe that God just has everything under control.
When you guys are canvassing or interacting with the public about Amazon, what is the overall sentiment of the public when you go door to door or put signs in people's yards and things? Haley, could you comment on that?
Sure. I haven't done a lot of canvassing quite yet. I'm going out this weekend right before the caravan, and I'm excited about it. But I will say, just from conversations with people that I've been having as often as I can, I am really surprised by how wide the support is. I think that even people who have not been historically pro-union can see the ways in which Amazon is exploiting people and can understand maybe for the first time why someone would want to join a union. It's taken a lot for a lot of these people to stand up and like Big Mike said, to show some leadership. I think it's been great.
Eric, can you talk about the caravan that's happening? Is that Saturday?
Yeah, so there is, we're calling it the Movement Caravan. And it's called the Movement Caravan because, one, we realize that as the date draws near for these votes to be tallied, of course, this campaign has garnered major national media attention. Celebrities have come to Alabama. We've had all of our national organizations come to Alabama. Reporters have flooded Alabama from literally all across the world just to hear from Amazon employees and organizers on the ground. But this movement caravan is very important because it consists of movement elders and present day movement leaders. And it's sponsored by Black Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter Global Network. And so we're literally pulling on the energy of our ancestors. We've partnered with the Alabama State Conference of the NAACP. We've partnered with the Poor People's Campaign, the Alabama's Poor People's Campaign. We've partnered with clergy. We've partnered with, Black Women's Roundtable. We've partnered with Black Voter Matters. All of these organizations literally are fighting to uplift and support Black communities. And so the reason why this movement caravan is very important is because we understand and we know that given the history of this country, Black people in general have been undervalued and haven't really earned the respect that they deserve. And we know that 80% or more of those employees that go to that fulfillment center every day to fulfill the mission of Amazon isn't necessarily valued by Amazon. And so we're rising up to say enough is enough. The people deserve to be treated with respect. The people deserve to be treated with dignity. And that's what we're fighting for. And so this is literally the third largest election in the country. The first was the presidential election. The second was in Georgia. And this is the third largest election in this country. We're going to make sure that we get a win on this because I really feel the energy. I feel the momentum building. And the South has something to say. And so the South is literally rising up. And now is our time that we, spread a message across the world that, enough is enough and Black lives do matter and Black lives will be valued.
Great. We have less than 1 minute left. Can you all say what can workers from the Kansas City area do to support the organizing drive? And any final comment that you want to make, if we could do that with maybe 30 seconds each?
I guess I would just like to say a quick closing remark that I believe that no matter what the outcome is at Bessemer, Alabama, that the labor movement is alive and it's well and it's going to keep going and it does not affect what the results is in Bessemer, Birmingham.
Eric or Haley, last comment?
Sure. I would just say, the comments of my brother, the labor movement is alive and well. This Black Lives Matter movement is alive and well.
Yes.
What I would say is, and what I actually wear two hats, one being a co-founder of BLM in Birmingham, but also being the co-chair of Our Revolution. And so we're literally fighting for the people, but we're also holding our elected officials accountable. And so what you can do is support people on the ground, support the organizations that's on the ground doing the work, connect with the local chapters and the local organizations and the national organizations. And then two, also, we've just passed this PRO Act, but we need to go a step further. And when I say go a step further, we need to demand that these major corporations that's receiving millions of dollars in federal contracts, that they do not use those dollars, taxpayers' dollars, to invest in union busting. And so if you're going to use taxpayer dollars to invest in union busting, then you don't deserve federal contracts, especially if you're trying to silence the people. And so that's the way. So, connect with the organizations on the ground.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much. We could talk for three shows about this, but good luck. We'll be watching you. And as Dr. King said decades ago, the time is always right to do what is right.
Good evening, and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, Journeyman Wireman of IBEW Local 124. Tonight, I'm going to speak to you about the National Union of Mine Workers strike of 1984 through 1985 in the UK and their most unlikeliest of allies. The coal industry in Great Britain had been nationalized in 1941, with a notice posted at every coal mine, "This colliery is now managed by the National Coal Board on behalf of the people." Mine owners were paid for their property, and management of the mines were transferred to be under the supervision of the National Coal Board, with 4% of the country's workers now being employed by a governmental agency instead of by over 800 different private employers. Fast forward to 1984. Margaret Thatcher had been elected Prime Minister in 1979, and in the time since, her party had pursued an agenda of deregulation and set about trying to undermine the power of labor unions. Word got around that the NCB had a list of mines it intended to close, and that it intended to cut coal production by 4 million tons. Modernization of equipment and other changes had already seen the coal workforce more than cut in half in recent decades, and the remaining miners were on the defensive and came to believe the time was now or never to make a final stand. Many communities across the UK had no other industries at all save their coal mines, and mine closure meant economic devastation for these communities. The NUM had a more decentralized structure than many in United States unions may be familiar with, and regions of the union acted semi-autonomously, with some regions being known to be more militant than others. Upon her election, Prime Minister Thatcher set about her plans to restructure the coal industry and intended to close mines that were considered the most inefficient, and fully expected resistance from the NUM and their president, Mr. Scargill, and planned accordingly. She directed the government to set up a 6-month stockpile of coal and appointed Ian McGregor, whom NUM President Scargill branded as that American butcher of British industries, to the helm of the NCB. Mr. McGregor had already been put at the helm of the national steel industry, and under his tenure, the steel workforce had been cut in half in just 2 years, so colliers had good reason to expect similar treatment. Ms. Thatcher also directed the police across the country to prepare for the probability of work stoppages and interruptions. On April 19, 1984, delegates at a special NUM conference voted not to have a national vote on whether to strike, as urged by President Scargill, but instead, the matter was left up to individual regions due to the vote for a national strike only being favored by a small majority of delegates. The strike was almost universally supported in Kent, Scotland, South Wales, Northeast England, and Yorkshire, but there was less support across North Wales and in the Midlands. Some mines in those regions stayed open, and the specially prepared police forces provided the strikebreakers with security. Bloody battles ensued in multiple regions between strikers and the police, the most notable being dubbed the Battle of Orgreave, which involved around 5,000 strikers and a similar number of police. The battle had begun after police cavalry attacked strikers with truncheons. Many legal attempts were made to stop the strike, from court injunctions to a ruling by one judge that the strikes were against the NUM's own constitution, as no national vote had been held on the matter. The NUM's elections that summer saw the unseating of nearly all leaders who had supported the strike and replacement with officers who did not. The matter became so divisive that many working miners broke away to form a new union, the Union of Democratic Miners, which Mr. McGregor was all too eager to recognize and work with instead. Although initially supportive of the miners and their fight to defend their livelihoods, Public opinion slowly turned against the miners as most of the media coverage concentrated the reporting on the violence, and in many cases exaggerated it and falsely portrayed it as being one-sided. A court injunction then froze the strike funds of the NUM, leading to an economic crisis for striking miners and their families. One of the more interesting aspects of this strike is the tie-in with the nascent British gay rights movement. A group calling itself Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners was organized to fundraise to support striking miner families, and members shook cans on street corners and held other fundraising events, the largest of which was a concert in London dubbed Pits and Perverts. Altogether, 11 LGSM groups were founded, and cumulatively they raised over $96,000 in today's dollars to support strikers. Although the strike ultimately failed, this solidarity proved to be a turning point for LGBT rights in the UK, with the hearts and minds of miners so moved that the union marched at the front of London's Gay Pride Parade in 1985, and was instrumental in the Labour Party's passage of a resolution supporting gay rights that same year. This episode of UK Labour history was dramatized in the 2014 award-winning movie Pride, for anyone out there wanting to learn more about the story. Have a great evening, everyone.
And now for the Heartland Labour Forum calendar. All Souls Unitarian Forum, Environmental Injustice to Rural Residents with Craig Volland and Everett Murphy, Sunday, March 14th, 10 a.m. Go to allsoulskc.org for a link. A civic discussion on the redevelopment of Cat's Drugstore. Boy, you know, that can really make you emotional. It's an historic site, and people's input is asked for. This is sponsored by the League of Women Voters. It's Tuesday, March 16th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. You can register at League of Women Voters KC, LWVKC.org. Healthcare workers at Research and Menorah are fighting for a fair contract. Join the car caravan to HCA Midwest Corporate Office Wednesday, March 17th at St. Patty's Day from 11 to 1. Something to do besides no parade. Meet at Laborers Local 264 at 1101 East 87th Street, KCMO. If you would like to RSVP for this, RSVP to Justin at mojwj.org. That's Jobs with Justice. Help Phone Bank or Canvas to renew the KCMO earnings tax. Tuesday from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. to Canvas. Thursdays, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. and Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. This is all you can do this in your home. Email Justin at mojwj.org. At least you can do the phone banking in your home. You can do the canvassing on your feet. UMKC Cesar Chavez Memorial Lecture with Yanira Marino, President of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. That's going to be Thursday, April 8th, 6 p.m. on Zoom, and go to the umkc.edu webpage and look for diversity events. That's it. You can find our calendar on our Facebook page. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to be talking about the Kansas City earnings tax election, and we're going to have lessons from the last stand of the steelworkers in Homestead, Pennsylvania. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Shots in the Night, KC's longest-running radio comedy theater program.
There is no disgrace in standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage. Cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI. Never to acknowledge the conditions where you've gone.